Today is Thursday, March 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The United Nations Security Council unanimously sends a message to the military leaders in Myanmar. Plus, life 10 years after the Fukushima earthquake in Japan.
My condolences go to those who continue to grieve the loss of loved ones.
And the implications of losing languages.
Language is a key identifier of identity.
We'll have these stories and more next. The United Nations Security Council on Wednesday unanimously approved a statement condemning the violence in Myanmar against peaceful protesters objecting to the February military takeover and called for the immediate release of the country's civilian leadership. Firing tear gas and rubber bullets, Myanmar security forces trapped hundreds of anti-junta protesters late into the night in two districts of Yangon on Wednesday. That action prompted the U.S. embassy to call for the forces to withdraw. Some protesters who managed to evade blockades set up by police and surrounding streets told of scores of arrests and said that some of those who got caught were beaten. A junta spokesperson did not respond to a request for comment. The military has brushed off condemnation of its actions, as it has in past periods of army rule when protests were forcibly repressed. The United States on Wednesday imposed sanctions on two children of Myanmar's military leader, Min Aung Hlaing, and six companies they control, increasing pressure on the military. Andrea Gackey, the director of the Office of Foreign Assets Control, said the United States will continue to work with its international partners to press the Burmese military and police to cease all violence against peaceful protesters and to restore democracy and the rule of law. Wednesday's move, the latest in a series of punitive actions taken by Washington against Myanmar's military over the coup, essentially freezes any U.S. assets of those blacklisted and generally bars Americans from dealing with them. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has released a statement commemorating the over 18,000 people dead or missing from the March 11, 2011 Great East Japan earthquake and tsunami.
Today is a solemn day of remembrance. My condolences go to those who continue to grieve the loss of loved ones. And I think of those who remain displaced, unable to return to their homes because of safety concerns surrounding the destroyed Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. In that regard, I welcome the reassuring findings of the United Nations Scientific Committee on the effects of atomic radiation. Japan is leading the world when it comes to disaster prevention. The country has invested heavily in building back safer over the last 10 years, and it has helped to share the lessons learned for the future. The Sendai Framework for Disaster Risk Reduction, adopted 6 years ago, is a global blueprint for a safer world. To prevent and manage disasters, countries need to plan, invest, give early warnings, and provide education on what to do. And they must prioritize the most vulnerable, such as the elderly and disabled. To manage the many risks that face us today, from earthquakes to biological hazards, from pandemics to extreme weather events, we must be inclusive so nobody is left behind when disaster strikes.
Just kilometers away from the Fukushima nuclear station, Japanese rancher Masami Yoshizawa raises more than 200 eradicated cattle as a symbol of anti-nuclear protest. Reuters' Jason Albano has his story.
The cows raised in Japan's Ranch of Hope can never be sold. They live just miles away from what was once the Fukushima nuclear station, the site of the world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl. In its wake, Japan's government ordered a widespread cull of livestock exposed to radiation. But for the past decade, rancher Masami Yoshizawa defied that order and kept his cows alive.
I've been exposed to radiation, but I chose to stay here. By keeping these cattle, I'm hoping for a world without nuclear power plants.
Hundreds of thousands of people were forced to leave their homes a decade ago following the disaster. Many cows starved to death as a result. But Yoshizawa stayed and took in animals left behind. Now he guards more than 200 catalyst protests against the government and Tokyo Electric Power, or TEPCO, which owned the Fukushima nuclear plant.
I hope that more people see these cattle stay alive for a long time, as a memorial of the disaster and as a symbol of anti-nuclear power.
Yoshizawa says it costs about $74,000 a year to feed them. That mostly comes from donations. He even drives a bulldozer every day to pick up rotting vegetables from supermarkets and food waste from factories to feed his cows at a lower cost. While he's received compensation for the disaster, he is also critical of what TEPCO has contributed to local residents. And every month, he takes his protest straight to the utility company's doors. Yoshizawa says he's probably the only rancher taking care of the affected cattle. But he also says he isn't slowing down anytime soon.
Jason Albano reports for Reuters News. The nightly internet shutdowns in Myanmar are part of a strategy employed by many governments worldwide in times of crisis. But they come with costs. VOA's Michelle Quinn takes it from here.
Nighttime in Myanmar, the country enters a digital curfew. In the morning, people check their phones to see if the internet is on. Then thousands jump on Siphon, a circumvention app to access sites such as Facebook, Twitter, and others, which the military junta has ordered blocked. From his office in Toronto, Canada, Michael Hull, president of Siphon, can see as people rush to get on Siphon servers. Siphon works with media outlets such as VOA.
The number of occurrences is unprecedented. And then from our point of view, from Siphon's point of view, the number of people that are having to utilize the Siphon network even after the network is restored is a new phenomenon.
It's unclear why the Myanmar military government, which seized control on February 1, is conducting nightly internet shutdowns. Governments typically argue that an internet shutdown helps maintain security in a time of crisis. Since the takeover, Myanmar has erupted in protests, with dozens of protesters killed. David Kay is a law professor at the University of California, Irvine, and a former United Nations special rapporteur.
The problem is that all the internet stuff is just a kind of prelude to something else, prelude to greater crackdown, harsher use of force, you know, more detentions of peaceful protesters.
In 2020, there were 155 internet shutdowns in 29 countries, according to Access Now, a nonprofit digital rights group. While fewer than in the prior 2 years, the blockages are still damaging. India, with 109 shutdowns, mostly in Indian-administered Kashmir, had the highest number. In Belarus, the internet went down in the European nation for 61 hours in August, after the presidential election. In addition to shutdowns, some governments are installing new censorship and surveillance capabilities on the network. Cambodia is setting up an internet gateway that critics say will give the government the ability to surveil and censor internet users. A U.S. State Department spokeswoman expressed concern.
You know, we have a significant amount of Khmer Americans who are here in the United States, and we want to ensure that they're able to freely speak to their family and their friends and relatives who are still back in the country.
In a place like Myanmar, internet shutdowns and blockages of social media sites come with economic costs and political risk. David Kay.
But they're also just deeply unpopular. They must really want to shut down the information flow because people rely on the internet.
Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
If you have questions or comments about any of tonight's stories, please connect with me on Twitter. I'm at It's Steve Miller. And coming up later,
a UN report on the human rights situation in Iran presents a bleak picture of a society living under a system of brutal political repression and rampant violations of fundamental freedoms.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute. A new study published in the American Heart Association's journal Circulation provides evidence that eating a mix of 5 daily servings of fruits and vegetables can lead to a longer life. The study specifies that of the 5 daily servings, 2 of fruit and 3 of vegetables provides the greatest longevity. The study's findings are based on an analysis of data gathered from several studies that included about 2 million people from around the world. The study also pointed out that not all fruits and vegetables are equal when it came to health benefits. The study suggests starchy vegetables and fruit juices were not linked with reduced risk of death. Instead, the study advises your diet should include green leafy vegetables along with fruit and vegetables that are full of beta-carotene and vitamin C. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A Saudi Arabian court has upheld the original sentence of a women's rights activist. Reuters' Olivia Chan has those details.
A Saudi court has upheld the original sentence of women's rights activist Lujaine Al-Hathloul, who had championed women's rights in the country. She was detained in May 2018 and sentenced in December to nearly 6 years in prison under broad cybercrime and counter-terrorism laws. Hathloul was released last month, having served half of her custodial sentence. She was hopeful when she walked into the courthouse Wednesday morning, only to see the court upholding her sentence.
Let's hope that the sentence has been changed or modified a little bit. We'll see how it goes. Thank you so much for your support.
The human rights activist rose to prominence in 2013 when she began publicly campaigning for women's rights to drive in Saudi Arabia. The ban on female drivers came to an end in 2018 after the law was changed. She also campaigned against the conservative kingdom's male guardianship system, which assigned each woman with a male relative to approve big decisions throughout a woman's life. Her sentencing drew widespread international condemnation. United Nations rights experts have called it spurious.
That was Reuters reporter Olivia Chan. A United Nations report on the human rights situation in Iran presents a bleak picture of a society living under a system of brutal political repression and rampant violations of fundamental freedoms. The report has been submitted to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein has more.
In his presentation to the Council, UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Iran, Javed Rehman, did not mince his words. He urged the international community to make Iran accountable for perpetrating what he called the most egregious violations with impunity.
It is beyond belief that almost 18 months since the deadly crackdown against the November 2019 protests in Iran, the government has still not conducted a proper investigation, nor held anyone accountable for the lethal force used against protesters, which caused at least 304 deaths.
Instead of investigating these crimes, Rehman noted, families seeking justice for relatives killed have been threatened by state agents. He suggested the reality of life in Iran is those who are innocent are punished, while the guilty go free. He cited a long list of violations, including Iran's high death penalty rate. He noted at least 267 executions took place last year, including several children. So far this year, more than 40 people reportedly have been put to death, many, he said, on the basis of torture-induced confessions as evidence. He expressed alarm at the continued arbitrary detention of dual and foreign nationals and the targeting of minorities, including through executions and disappearances. A major focus of the investigator's report is on the human rights situation of women and girls, which he considered largely abysmal and unacceptable.
While some positive steps, such as in education and in citizenship rights, are recognized, egregious gender-based discrimination persists in law, practice, and societal attitudes, disempowering women and girls from participating and contributing in society.
Iranian ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Ismail Baghai Khamenei, called the report one-sided and said it is based on disinformation.
For more than 10 years now, this particular interactive debate has been used as a platform to launch a rhetorical campaign against Iran under the guise of human rights. The way human rights discourses are framed and weaponized by a certain group of states to score points in their political conflicts against their adversaries should be a matter of serious concern.
The Iranian ambassador said the establishment of a special rapporteur on Iran's human rights lacks any legitimate grounds. He added it was not fair or justified and should be abandoned. Lisa Schlein for VOA News. Geneva.
Rights monitors and security officials say the father of a missing anti-government activist believed abducted by a militia in southern Iraq has been shot and killed. Jaseb Hatab Aboud had been searching for his son since his kidnapping in October of 2019. The son was one of a number of activists who vanished during anti-government protests believed to have been snatched by militias. Aboud was unusual among parents of the missing because he led a vocal campaign for his son and sought to prosecute a militia leader suspected in the kidnapping. Aboud was shot in the head on Wednesday in the southern city of Amara. Last March, when the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a pandemic, it had already proved to be lethal and highly contagious. It was a new virus with many unknowns. Now, since then, scientists have learned a lot about how it affects vital organs and its long-term effects. VOA's Carol Pearson has that story.
COVID-19 is a respiratory disease caused by a virus, officially known as SARS-CoV-2, short for Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome Coronavirus 2. It's the second time a coronavirus has sickened people and caused death. SARS first appeared in China in November 2002. The current version of the virus emerged from China in 2019, which is why it's called COVID-19. The virus invades the lungs. It multiplies and neutralizes the molecules that help us fight infection. Most people recover, but the virus can damage the lungs and leave patients gasping for air. Thomas Steele needed a double lung transplant because of COVID.
It's nothing like sitting in your hospital room, gasping for every breath air you take. And I did that for 58 days.
The lungs pass oxygen into the bloodstream, and the virus can damage the lungs and make the oxygen levels fall. Patients may need to be put on a ventilator to help them breathe. COVID-19 can also cause dangerous clotting in the bloodstream. People who already have damaged blood vessels from high blood pressure or stroke, and those with heart disease, have a higher risk of serious disease. These clots can form throughout the body, including in the lungs and the heart. The clotting can cause heart attack or stroke. Dr. Alan Anderson is one of many cardiologists who saw people with healthy hearts suffer heart damage.
They had elevations of blood enzyme markers that were consistent with a heart attack, even though they didn't have any blockages in their coronary arteries. They had heart rhythm disturbances, and that this occurred with quite high prevalence.
The virus and the inflammation that accompanies it can damage the heart tissue, and some of the damage can be reversed, but some cannot. Doctors have also learned that the virus can damage another vital organ, the kidneys. A large New York medical system looked at more than 5,000 COVID patients last year. Their findings? Dr. Kinar Javari at Hofstra Northwell in Great Neck, New York, was the lead author whose findings were published in the journal Kidney International.
Of the 5,449 patients, 36.6% of them developed acute renal failure or kidney injury. Of the ones that got kidney injury, 14% required dialysis.
Scientists are still studying the impact of COVID-19 on the body, but the most severe effects start with the lungs. Damaged lungs have a harder time getting oxygen to the bloodstream, and organs need oxygen to function. If there is none, they can fail. The lungs, the heart, the kidneys, and the liver. And then there are the long-term consequences of the disease. Some are not life-threatening, but can affect the quality of life. Symptoms may include persistent fatigue, headache, shortness of breath, or chest pain. Others may experience brain fog or memory issues, and still others have lingering feelings of anxiety and depression. Anyone, not just those who are hospitalized, can have long-term symptoms, and there's no way to tell who will be affected. Dr. Kristen England is an infectious disease specialist at Cleveland Clinic.
We don't really know right now how many patients will develop these long COVID symptoms after they have had this infection. Studies look at anywhere between 10% and 80%. So there could be a large number of people who are experiencing symptoms well after, again, that four-week time period when we expect people to normally recover.
Some medical centers have started special clinics to treat the long haulers, people whose symptoms persist even after they have recovered from COVID. Others may not be long haulers, but their lives have changed drastically because of COVID-19.
I'll never be the same person for the rest of my life.
He is one of many who will never be the same because of COVID-19. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
And when the coronavirus first emerged, many East Asian countries were hailed as global examples due to their impressive containment efforts. But some of those countries are falling behind in their vaccine campaigns. VOA's Bill Gallo.
South Korea was among the first countries hit by the coronavirus. And the virus hit hard, devastating its third largest city in February. But South Korea contained the pandemic within weeks, winning praise for its formula of track, treat, and trace. It may then come as a surprise that South Korea was among the last developed countries to start vaccinations. They're not alone. By some estimates, it may be at least the middle of 2022 before even the wealthiest parts of East Asia get widespread vaccines. In South Korea, there were high hopes for a domestically produced vaccine, but that hasn't happened, leading some to question whether Seoul was overconfident.
You can guarantee testing. You can guarantee public health. I mean, of course, it's not easy, but these are things you just get done. But a vaccine is science, and it's not like you just spend a bit of time and money and you get a vaccine. There's a lot of luck, experiments, and all this.
Doctor and academic Ogon Gorel says vaccine nationalism may be partly responsible for the delay.
We can do things on our own and so forth, and perhaps we're forced to do things on our own, plus we may want to do things on our own. And so perhaps some of the partnerships and the interactions with external vaccine producers may not have been developed as rapidly. And so Korea is late in this game.
Another reason some Asian countries delayed the vaccine, the virus never spread out of control, unlike in the United States and Britain, says Fitch analyst Anwita Basu.
The vaccination in these two countries is a lot more important than for countries like South Korea, countries like Japan, where they can take a more cautious approach because they do have the ability to, control the spread in other ways.
For South Korea, those tools included fast and affordable coronavirus tests. It also meant empowering the government to conduct intense contact tracing using cell phone and other data. But those steps will only contain the pandemic. Vaccines, the one tool that could end it, are happening at a much slower pace. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
The Smithsonian Institution's Mother Tongue Film Festival kicked off in February of this year. The sixth annual event will feature virtual screenings of the films through May. The festival features filmmakers from around the world and shares the importance of language in everyday life. But what's the importance of endangered languages on society?
My name's Lenore Grenoble. I'm the John Matthews Manley Distinguished Service Professor. What's a language, what's a dialect, and those are big questions that linguists think about a lot. There's probably between 6,000 and 7,000 languages. So if that 10,000 number is right, but that's just a complete guess, we've lost 3,000. usually people shift their language. So they stop speaking their ancestral language, if you will, and start speaking the language of the majority population. Sometimes they want to do that, and sometimes they are sort of forced to do that. So Native American languages are very endangered right now, and a lot of that goes back to boarding schools where children were taken into the boarding schools and forced to speak English and gave up their language. And when those children became parents, they didn't want their kids to suffer the way they had. So they generally spoke English to their parents. But there's lots of reasons that people feel social pressure for economic advancement, for social pressure, political pressure, language policies. It's a really complicated issue. The single biggest diagnostic, let's say, of an endangered language is when the children aren't speaking the language. So if the children have shifted to another language, let's say, you know, a Native American language, and the children only speak English, then the language is endangered because you need future speakers. And you need future speakers to keep carrying on the language. Languages with very small populations of speakers are more vulnerable because they can shift very quickly. You can lose the speakers very quickly. Language is a key identifier of identity. And so where certain populations are targeted for ethnic cleansing, those speakers may hide their identity by ceasing to speak the language. So of course, besides the fact that genocide, of course, kills the speakers and is a horrible thing, it also can cause language shift and loss because people want to live. We find that those communities that are working to reclaim their language come together, and sometimes they learn a lot more of their language and sometimes they don't, but they find strength in that. And we see all kinds of indicators of both physical and mental well-being improves. With so many problems going on, it's hard to see this one, but this is part of everybody's problem.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It is grotesque abuse, a government seizing foreign nationals and imprisoning them, separating them from their families, often without legal redress, to gain leverage over another country. A broad coalition of nations has now formally come together to denounce the practice. Led by Canada, 58 nations, including the United States, Australia, and Japan, and almost all members of the European Union, have endorsed a declaration condemning state-sponsored arbitrary detention of foreign nationals for political purposes. The declaration affirms the principles of human rights and the rule of law concerning arbitrary detention, as outlined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and Vienna Convention on Consular Relations. The declaration affirms that its signatories stand in solidarity with states whose nationals, including dual citizens, have been arbitrarily arrested, detained, or sentenced by other states seeking to exercise leverage over them, and acknowledge the need to work collaboratively to address this issue of mutual concern at the international level. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken congratulated Canada for leading the way on this important issue and for obtaining the endorsement of many countries. In a statement, he called arbitrary detentions in state-to-state relations a heinous act against the human rights of the individuals in question and an affront to international diplomatic norms. At a virtual declaration announcement ceremony hosted by Canada and attended by high-level officials from dozens of countries, Secretary Blinken called the practice completely unacceptable.
This kind of arbitrary detention goes against the human rights of the people being held. It brings anguish to their families, and it's a threat to anyone who travels, works, or lives abroad. It's time to send a clear message to every government that arbitrarily detains foreign nationals and tries to use them as leverage. This will not be tolerated by the international community.
The fact that so many countries are endorsing this declaration is a sign of its strength, Secretary of State Blinken said. Now let's keep the momentum going. I urge more countries to join us in making it clear that arbitrary detention has absolutely no place in state-to-state relations. Human beings are not bargaining chips. This is a matter of human rights and the rule of law. We'll stand up for both together.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.